It's my unique pleasure today to introduce a very unique person. It's Narayana Murthy. I can speak volumes for him, but let me just say a couple of very important contributions that he has made. Many of us today look at the history of India and the recent successes, and we associate a face, that of Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, who launched the reforms back in 1991. Today, there's another very important face that we associate with India's success story, and that is a Mr. Murthy. Because the company that he co-founded with six other software engineers, with a lifetime savings of $250 back in 1986, today is a large global company with a global market capitalization of $26 billion, the last time I checked this today. And not only has he built a global success story, but he has also inspired many generations of entrepreneurs in India and elsewhere. He has also created a very unique business culture, which today stands for clean, transparent governance, open culture, and really empowerment of the individual employee. He can take full credit for his company having created many hundreds of millionaires amongst his employees in India, because his company was the first to offer stock options to employees in India. Even today, Infosys sets a very high bar in terms of corporate governance, openness, and transparency. His achievements in business are exemplary, but he's also a very unique human being. And I was personally very touched, and I saw a glimpse of his humanity when in 2006, I've known Mr. Murthy for more than a decade now. In 2006, I was living in France, and I just happened to mention to him casually that my daughter was applying for her school leaving exams, and I was having some difficulty in helping her in some of the scientific subjects because her textbooks were in French and my French was not up to par. And I was missing some of the books that I had studied myself in India in high school chemistry, high school physics, and high school mathematics. And Mr. Murthy went back after that meeting, and unknown to me, two big boxes of books arrived for my daughter from India, and they contained all kinds of high school textbooks in physics, chemistry, and maths, both for her and I think also for me to be able to help her. So, you know, that's a small example of the human touch. You have a conversation with, you know, someone somewhere, and you remember the fine detail and you try and help back. And this is what makes him unique today. He and his wife, Sudha, are very actively involved in trying to spread the word and the spirit of social entrepreneurship in India. They have Infosys Foundation, which they are using actively to engage in many different social entrepreneurship programs in the country. Now, Mr. Murthy has a very strong connection to Cornell. He served as a university trustee from 2003 to 2011. And since then, he has been a trustee emeritus, presidential counselor. His family also has a very strong link. His son, Rohan, is a 2005 graduate of the Cornell College of Engineering. So, Mr. Murthy, welcome back to Cornell. This is your home. We're very pleased to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Soumitra, for those kind words. Well, you people have to discount it, given that it comes from a very good friend. Well, when Soumitra spoke to me, he asked me to speak on entrepreneurship, some of the lessons that I have learned from this journey. First of all, why was Infosys founded? I used to be a strong leftist in my student days, It was not very difficult to be a leftist in India during the days of Jawaharlal Nehru, the closeness between India and Soviet Union. However, when I went to France to work there in early 70s, I was part of a team that designed an operating system for handling air cargo for Charles de Gaulle Airport. I learned a lot outside the office, I must confess. I knew my computer science reasonably well, at least to the extent of writing an operating system. But more importantly, I learned a lot outside the office. I met people from the left, the center, and the right. In fact, I had long discussions with the then leader of the French Communist Party, Georges Marchais. And I came to the conclusion that societies don't solve the problem of poverty by slogans, but they solve the problem of poverty by creation of jobs with good disposable income. And that's where I realized entrepreneurship becomes extremely important. And while I was hitchhiking from Paris to my hometown, Mysore, I took about 11 months. I spent all of $450. And I was incarcerated in a railway station in Bulgaria because one of the persons that I was sitting with on in a railway compartment felt that I was plotting against the great nation of Bulgaria. And therefore, he called the police, and they took me away, and they put me in a room which was 8 feet by 8 feet, cold floor. They took away my sleeping bag and backpack. And I was left there without food or water for about 76 hours. And then they put me on a goods train, on a freight train. And I was without food or water for an overall period of 121 hours. That's when I thought deeply. And then I got myself transformed from being a confused leftist to a determined, compassionate capitalist. And that, in essence, is the reason why Infosys was founded. As Soumitra pointed out, Infosys was founded in 1980s with $250, borrowed mostly from our generous spouses. Last year, the revenue was about $7 billion US, and the net income was about $1.6 billion. Even today, we are perhaps among the top five high-tech companies in terms of profitability. The market capitalization, as I said, is about $26, $27 billion. We operate in about 33 countries. We have about 1,200 customers. And we have employees from 92 nationalities. We got listed in India on the Indian Stock Exchange in 1993, and we got listed on NASDAQ in 1999. We are today part of NASDAQ 100. To me, entrepreneurship is all about creating jobs and wealth from ideas. It is about transforming the world with your new products and ideas. It is therefore about courage. It is about making the plausibly impossible happen. I use Robert Kennedy's words, and he himself borrowed them from George Bernard Shaw, to define entrepreneurship. Robert Kennedy used it to define leadership. And he said, most people see things as they are and wonder why. I dream of things that never were and then say, why not? In essence, to me, this is what entrepreneurship is all about. That is to dream of things that are not there today and then say, why not? Entrepreneurs are basically leaders, since entrepreneurship starts with nothing but an idea. They promise a rainbow to their people and exhort their people to leap high and catch a part of that rainbow and put it in their pocket. Entrepreneurs are leaders because, as you people know, leadership is all about raising the aspirations of people. It is about making them more confident, more hopeful. It is about making them do the impossible stuff. Now let me come to the attributes of success for entrepreneurship that I have experienced or that I have seen, and I have discussed with many people, including Bill Gates, and by and large we all agree on that. And they are, one, you need to have an idea whose differentiated value proposition to the market must be expressible in a simple sentence. Not a complex sentence, not a compound sentence. No ifs, no buts, no nevertheless. Why? Because it is a cluttered market. There are lots of people out there, lots of entrepreneurs coming out with new ideas. And therefore, if your idea has to receive attention in the marketplace, it has to be expressible in a simple sentence. In other words, the idea has to reduce cost or reduce cycle time or improve productivity, enhance customer base or enhance customer comfort, etc., etc. Unless such an idea can be expressed simply, it is very unlikely that the idea would succeed in the marketplace. I have seen so many ideas fail simply because they were not simple and direct in terms of expressing their differentiated value proposition to the market. Now, our idea was to develop customized software solutions for corporations on time, within budget, and exceeding quality expectations of the customers. Now, how is it a differentiated value proposition? You have to go back to 1980s when we talked about this idea. At that point of time, the success rate of most large software projects in this country was about 45%. So therefore, we said, we will adopt such quality processes, methods, and tools. We will put in such productivity improvement tools. We'll recruit such people. We'll train them in such a way that we can indeed get to 90% success rate. In fact, I would say that today, the success rate of projects undertaken by Infosys of huge projects. This is, you're talking of 500-person months, 1,000-person months, 2,000-person months, etc. And the success rate is about 96%. Now, the next important criterion that I have realized for an entrepreneur to succeed is that the market must be ready for your idea. No matter how good your idea is, no matter how smart you are, if the market doesn't recognize your idea as being useful, it won't help. There are many, many examples. For example, Hewlett Packard produced a tablet. It just didn't take off. Dell introduced a tablet. It didn't. None of them could really compete with iPad, which had the differentiated value proposition. Similarly, when I used to work in France in the early 70s, Philips produced a wonderful
mini computer, 16-bit mini computer. But somehow, the market didn't see that computer as exciting as the ones introduced by Digital Equipment Corporation or Data Journal, etc. So unless the market is ready, your idea won't succeed. Therefore, it is very, very important for you to conduct a pilot study of the market expectations and market satisfaction before you can really launch. For example, I started a company called Softronics before I founded Infosys in 1976 to develop large-scale software for the Indian clients. But the Indian clientele was not ready for large-scale software projects, and that didn't take off. And pretty quickly, I realized and closed it. And then I realized that I had to look for markets in the developed nations where it's, you know, very few things were happening. There were three events that happened in the middle 70s that created the market for us in the US and then, of course, a little bit in Europe. First was the unbundling of software and hardware. Till then, the hardware companies like IBM and the bunch, the Burroughs, Univac, NCR, Cray, and Honeywell, they insisted that only their software had to be run on their hardware. But a judge in Minneapolis in 1976 or so ruled that this was not right, and it should be possible for third-party software to be run on the hardware provided by these vendors. And we realized that there was going to be a huge demand for software from third-party vendors. The second thing that happened was the arrival of super mini computers, the 32-bit super mini computers from Digital Equipment Corporation, Data Journal, etc. And these machines were very, very powerful, but they were very cheap compared to the mainframes. Therefore, we knew that more and more medium level corporations in this country would buy these machines, and therefore there'll be great opportunity for software to be developed for them. Third thing that happened was the second part of the second thing that happened was that these vendors, DEC and DG and others, provided what is called online transaction processing software based on relational databases on these machines. As most of you know, in a business application, you have the concept of a transaction where a certain number of tables or files will have to be updated, or none of them will have to be updated, because if only a few files, a few tables got updated and few did not get, then the system will be unstable, and you'll have to go back and roll back all the updates. Such a piece of software is an absolute necessity for building any large-scale application, and these were introduced in 1978-79. And the last one was, in India, we found that there were lots of engineers being produced by good institutes of technology and engineering, but they didn't have too many jobs. Therefore, we said, if we can combine the huge explosion of opportunities in large-scale software development in the West, particularly in the US, with the availability of well-trained talent in India, and if we put in processes, tools, technologies, and methodologies and systems, then we will be able to provide to our customers high-quality software on time, within budgeted cost, and we would also get to a level of 90% in terms of success rate of these projects, and therefore everybody would be a winner. That was our differentiated value proposition, and I think, you know, it has come pretty far from the first year revenue of $130,000 or so to about $7 billion last year. The next principle that I have learned is that when you put together a team to succeed as an entrepreneur, you have to put together a team that has what I would term mutually exclusive but collectively exhaustive set of skills, expertise, and experience. In other words, you need to bring people who understand technology, people who understand quality, people who understand finance, people who understand human resources, people who understand strategy, etc. Today it is easy because the venture capitalists do the required job of connecting an entrepreneur with the prospective key employee network. But in the late 70s and early 80s, we did not have any venture capital system in India. And therefore, we had to bring ourselves, and we knew that if we had to bring all this talent, we have to enroll them, at least one or two key people, as the co-founders. That's what I did. The next principle that I learned pretty early was, after all, entrepreneurship is about deferred gratification. It is all about huge sacrifices today, being away from the family, working hard, leading a very austere life, and hoping that tomorrow will bring you big fortune. Tomorrow will bring you the realization of your dream. And if you want to do that, if you want many people to follow your dream, if you want many people to accept this idea of yours, then they all need to have a certain value system, that of deferred gratification, that of making sacrifices today in the hope of a better tomorrow. They have to have optimism. They have to have honesty. They have to have good work ethic. They have to have courage. They have to have trust in each other. And therefore, I think a good value system is extremely important for an entrepreneur and his team. I've realized the best way you can get people to believe in you, to trust you, is leadership by example. Unless you walk the talk, unless you demonstrate your belief in your idea by actually practicing your precept, it is unlikely that other people will trust you. Therefore, the best instrument that a leader has to create trust in people is to walk the talk. If the leader makes the sacrifice, then people would say, look, if this is good for him, that is good for him or her, it's good for us too. So therefore, leadership by example is extremely important. There were two major innovations that we brought to the table when we founded the company. First is called the global delivery model. In any large software project that one takes up for a customer, there are two classes of activity. There are two types of activities. The first one is the set of activities that have a very high level of interaction with customer. Activities like interviewing the customer, finalizing the requirements, presentation to the customer, sign-off by the customer, installation of the software, training the customer on how to use the software that you have developed, and then performance optimization under full load, and finally what we call rapid reaction warranty. That is the warranty that you have to give in the first few months of any large-scale software that you develop. All these activities will have to be necessarily delivered at customer side. On the other hand, activities like detailed functional design, architecture, database design, programming, testing, documentation, and long-term warranty. These activities can be delivered from remote, scalable, quality tools driven, process driven, and talent rich and cost competitive development centers in countries like India and other countries. The result is, in a typical project, about 20 to 25% of the effort has to be delivered at customer side, and 75% to 80% could be delivered from remote places. The result is customer gets high-quality software on time within budgeted cost at very attractive prices. This is our first innovation. The second was the concept called 24-hour workday. When we came here first in early 80s, our prospects were very kind to us. They gave us a cup of coffee or tea, and then they said, please don't call, we'll call you. And we went back to India and said, oh, my God, this doesn't look like it's going to work. And the main reason why they said that was, in fact, one of the prospects told us, he said, look, India and U.S. are as different, literally as day and night, because when it is night in the U.S., it is morning in India, and when it is night in India, it's morning in the U.S. How can you and I work together? It's impossible. So when we came back to India, we went to the drawing board, and we said, we have to find a solution. That's when we came out with the concept of 24-hour workday. Because India is anywhere between 9.5 hours and 12.5 hours with respect to the U.S., we said by combining the prime time of our customer staff here in the U.S. with our prime time, we will be in a position to provide a 24-hour workday for our customer, and therefore we can compress cycle time. This is very critical, particularly in some time-critical activities, in some maintenance activities. For example, at 5:30 or 6 o'clock in the evening here, the people could say, these are the issues that have not yet been sorted out, and they go home. And then we come to the office bright and early at 7:45 in the morning, and we start solving those problems, and we finish those things, and at 6 o'clock in the evening, we go home. And at 8 o'clock in the morning, our customer staff come here, and their problems have been solved. In other words, when they're sleeping, their problems would have been solved. And when we presented this idea to the next prospect, the prospect was blown off his mind. He just couldn't believe that this was possible. So the point I'm making is simply this. No matter how committed you are, you have to bring innovation to the table if you want to succeed as an entrepreneur. Talking about innovation, we have realized that the best instrument you have to keep innovation alive in your organization is to proactively obsolete your own innovation from time to time. Because if you don't obsolete those innovations yourself, your competitor could do it, and then you are caught off guard. So the better thing is to say, this is our innovation, we will take advantage of it for the next 3 months or 6 months, and we will widely disseminate in the industry. So therefore, it is very, very important for you people to proactively obsolete your own innovations. The other thing, there are many other lessons that I have learned, but let me talk one about the customers, one about employees, and one about investors before I close. We realized pretty early that there's only one person who puts food on the table for you, for a corporation, and that is the customer. There is nobody else who gives money month after month after month for a corporation. Therefore, it is extremely important for everybody in your corporation to realize that unless the customer is satisfied with you, there is no hope for the organization. In fact, as Sam Walton often used to say, there is only one person, there's only one person who can fire the CEO and the chairman just by taking his business away from the company. Insofar as employees are concerned, we have realized that first-raters must hire first-raters, because if you don't do that, if you hire a second-rater, he or she will hire a third-rater, because they all want to be very comfortable in the company of people who are less smart than them. Therefore, before you can say Jack Robinson, the organization will be full of nth raters. So it is very, very difficult to work with first raters because they have their own ideas. Therefore, an important requirement for a leader, for a manager, is to make sure that he or she works with smart people. We have also realized that there are 6 time invariant and context invariant attributes for the success of a corporation. They are: 1, an environment of openness to new ideas, fairness and justice in every decision that you take, meritocracy of ideas, or hierarchy of ideas, meritocracy, speed, imagination or innovation, and excellence in execution. As long as the leader of your venture embrace fairness and justice, as long as you embrace openness to new ideas, as long as you embrace meritocracy, as long as you say, we will do things faster today compared to yesterday, or last month, last quarter, last year, as long as you say, we will be more innovative today compared to yesterday, and as long as you say, we will execute those ideas with a better level of excellence today compared to yesterday, I think the organization will succeed. Now, coming to investors, we have realized that investors understand that businesses will have ups and downs. What they want you to do is to bring bad news to them proactively and early. For example, in 1995, we had a Fortune 10 customer who contributed 25% of our top line and just 8% of our bottom line. And that customer came to us to renegotiate the prices. And we sat down with the customer's officers and explained to them why that's not a good idea for the customer corporation. Because we said we have to invest in people, we have to invest in technology, in infrastructure, in quality, in productivity, etc., etc. And to do that, you are the one who will give the money. Therefore, please don't take a short-term view of it. But there were competitors of ours who agreed, and we decided to walk out of business. We had been listed only a year before, and everybody thought that I was being crazy to do this. But within 48 hours of it, we went to the analysts and told them that this is what has happened, and this is our plan to correct that anomaly. And investors like this, because investors say, look, at the end of the day, From time to time, these people may not be smart, but one thing we know, that these people will always be honest. That's why we always say, when in doubt, disclose. We also say, let the bad news take the elevator and let the good news take the staircase. So it's very, very important to bring bad news to investors proactively and early. Finally, let me say this, that the best index of success of a corporation is its longevity. And those corporations that have been in business for long have done one thing right, and that is they have lived in harmony with the society. Living in harmony with the society is perhaps the most important aspect of any leadership. Why? Because society contributes customers, society contributes employees, society contributes investors, society contributes bureaucrats, society contributes politicians. Therefore, unless you have the goodwill of the society, I don't think the corporation will succeed in the long term. Therefore, those of us who have aspiration to be a long-term company will first ask the question, whatever I am doing, is it good for this society? If it is good for the society, then it will be good for you too. I think that is an extremely important message that all of us have to keep in mind, because without exception, those corporations that did not do it have disappeared. Well, I can go on and on and on because there were so many lessons, but I'll stop here and I will I'll take questions, and then I will, you know, try and answer them to the best of my abilities. Thanks. We still have some time.
Thank you so much. You certainly heard why Mr. Muthi is such an inspirational leader. And this is a wonderful chance for you to be able to pose some questions to him. You might also be aware that in 2012, Fortune magazine named him as one of the 12 greatest entrepreneurs of our time. So please do raise your hand. And I think there's a microphone that will be brought to you, or people are coming up here. We'll bring a microphone over to you. Just raise your hand, please, and we'll try and get a microphone over to you.
Yeah, please.
You mentioned that uniqueness of idea is important to go through the clutter of the market. And so my question is, what role does marketing play in removing the clutter? And an entrepreneur with limited resources, how should he go about that?
Well, you know, sales is about closing a deal. Marketing is about reducing friction to sales. So the primary responsibility of the marketing group in a company is to make it easier for salespeople to succeed in their task. That's the role of marketing.
Start by just thanking you for your remarks, which I've enjoyed very much, and for your personal generosity. You made a comment that interested me. You talked about the climate for managers and the tendency for them to pick people who are second rate because they felt rewards in this, and the need to create a culture that encourages your managers to pick first rate people. I'm wondering, in the broader ecosystem, as you look at the lessons you've learned at Infosys, if you see insights that apply to society in a broader way, because it's clear that some companies have a positive impact on society. Some not. Some governments do better than others. And I'm wondering, how are these kinds of insights from Infosys transferable to other settings?
Well, I think after all, a corporation is a community. It's a group of people who have come together with a common vision, with a common objective. A corporation ideally should have a very high level of diversity to get the best ideas to the table, and therefore, in some sense, they reflect the society. A corporation is a microcosm of the society. And therefore, I do believe that, by and large, a well-intentioned corporation, a corporation where the leaders have considerable appreciation for the role of society in their future, will indeed conduct themselves, will indeed do whatever is necessary for replicating the good ideas of the society. The primary difference between the public governance system and the private governance system or the corporate governance system is, in the public governance system, while the objective is highly laudable, the accountability is highly defocused. That's why most public governance systems are not very efficient in all the countries. On the other hand, in a private governance system, in a corporation, the ideas may not be as laudable as that of the nation or the society is, but there is a laser focus on achieving the objective. For example, I say corporate governance is all about maximizing shareholder value in such a way that there is fairness, transparency, and accountability to every stakeholder, that is customer, employee, investor, vendor partner, government of the land, and the society. So I would say, by and large, the ideas of a private governance system applies to even a larger entity in terms of efficiency, in terms of vision, in terms of commitment, in terms of diversity, in terms of discussion, debate, enlightened democracy. I would say a private governance system ideally should operate as an enlightened democracy.
Good evening, sir.
Yeah.
I have two questions.
No, one at a time. Otherwise, I'll forget it.
Okay. The first question is, there's a saying, to become a leader, you need to be a slave initially. So is it true? And if it is, how could you relate this with your experience?
No, I don't agree with that. As I said, leadership is all about dreaming an aspirational objective, an aspirational vision, bringing together a set of people, exhorting them, and giving them confidence, making them more hopeful, and make them more committed and enthusiastic about achieving what seems impossible, but what is plausible. Every one of us has leadership potential in us, but not all of us get the opportunity to demonstrate it in our workplace. Let me give you a very simple example. Let's say I have my driver, who in the office is generally not required to sit in discussions on strategy and all of that. Therefore, he or she is not playing that important a role in terms of leadership in the company. But at home, the person gives confidence to his children. If one of the children is not well, he brings confidence to the house. He talks, he makes sure that they're enthusiastic even in that situation. He makes sure that his or her children come up. In other words, every one of us has an opportunity to show leadership in different contexts. So therefore, I don't agree with you that you have to be a slave to become a leader.
Where's the microphone?
Yeah.
Okay. You're seeing many hands now, so we'll have to try and keep the questions short, please. Yeah.
Good evening, sir. So before asking my question, I just had to say that it's an honor and an inspiration to be in the same room as you and hearing you speak. So thank you very much for coming to Cornell.
Thank you.
And I'd like to ask you my question now. One of the things which most non-Indians don't know about you and most Indians don't know about you is even after achieving such success, you lead a very simple lifestyle. And the reason I say this is because I happened to be at a wedding which you were also present in Calcutta. And you came in without much fanfare, quietly by the side, and it took about 40 minutes for people to realize that Mr. Narayan Murthy is in the room. So how do you manage to keep a low profile, and how do you manage to keep such a simple lifestyle even after achieving success? And why do you do this?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for those kind words. Now, I think all of us have to lead a life that we are most comfortable with. And that comes naturally to us. And therefore, I think I came from a family of 8 children. Father was a high school teacher. So I came from what I could term a lower middle class family, and that's what I'm very comfortable with. You have to do what you're comfortable with. There's nothing extraordinary about it. You are being your own natural self.
Okay, we'll take a question that side.
Yeah.
Maybe the lay. Okay, yeah, please.
Good evening, sir. Thank you for the talk today. You talked about innovation and you talked about society. I would like to put the two together. And my question is, with our current, the model of the Indian economy, which is largely service-based right now, and at the risk of sounding like oversimplifying it, do you think India has, as a society, has forgotten to innovate that transforms, barriers in the world? And if it hasn't forgotten to innovate, are we losing out on environments that are conducive to innovation? Thank you.
No, I think there are areas where there have been innovations. India has two requirements for success. One, your per unit price of any product that you introduce has to be low because the disposable income is low. Second, you have to quickly scale up the organization if you want to make a reasonable amount of money. Because the per unit profit is low, if you want to make decent amount of profit, then you have to produce large number of units, and you have to sell large number of units. And there are lots of innovative ideas that have come in that area, particularly in addressing the bottom of the bottom of the pyramid customers. And wherever it is needed, it is happening. Certainly, we could do a lot more and become more and more innovative. There is no doubt about it. But I wouldn't say that we have forgotten innovation, no. I myself gave you two examples of innovation that we did, and there are many, many more that I could have spoken about in my own company. And, there are many others who have brought in lots of innovations.
maybe in the center, please. Just wait for the microphone.
Thank you for giving me a chance to speak, sir. I'm an entrepreneur myself from India. I was there for 5 years doing my own business. So my question is that for doing a business or for being an entrepreneur, you have to have belief in your idea, which you had in case of Infosys. And at some point of time, you also should know when to pull out of the market if you're not doing well, like in your previous company. So I have myself been in a situation where I've actually invested the last $250 as well, and I've failed in the business. So I wanted to know much about how do you actually differentiate between, you know, believing and then pulling out of the market if your business is actually not doing well.
You know, I mean, I run a venture capital firm in India. I mean, after I left Infosys, I started a VC firm. And one of the biggest problems we have is to convince entrepreneurs to give up on an idea that everybody around them knows is going to fail, because they are so passionate about their ideas, they just don't see, it's their blind spot. So the best way to do would be, as I said earlier, data and facts should be used in coming to conclusions on these things. Market surveys are very, very useful. Then cost of producing it is another factor. And as long as you use data and facts, and then you can indeed see the reality. But if it is all based on opinion, if it is based on emotion, it just won't happen. That's why we at Infosys, we always say, in God we trust, everybody else brings data to the table. So it's very important. It's extremely important to use data. The good thing about bringing data and facts to the table is, even if I lose this transaction to Sumitra, I would say, look, this time I did not have proper data, therefore I lost it. Next time, if I have better data, better arguments, I am likely to win. Therefore, I won't get disappointed. I won't lose faith in the system. So I would say that please look at data and facts before you arrive at any conclusion, and be detached from the situation to the extent that the data and facts can be analyzed very rationally.
One time, one last question, the lady up there.
Please. Sir, it's an honor to hear you talk. For us students and engineers living here, studying here, what would you say is a better option, like from hearing you talk, how you started in India in 1980s with the idea of a customer base in US?
Sorry, I didn't hear clearly. Say it again.
You said you started in India, but with a customer base in US initially.
Yeah.
What in current world and Indian economy, which is better, like for us to start in US with a US customer base or start in India with an Indian customer base?
Well, you know, in fact, one important point I didn't make when I was speaking, and that is, Infosys was founded on my definition of globalization. To me, globalization is the paradigm that helps you to source capital from where it is cheapest, source talent from where it is best available, produce where it is most cost effective, and sell where the markets are without being constrained by national boundaries. That's why if a country X produces the best products and brings it to the global bazaar, it's likely to succeed today. Today, your success depends not just on what companies in this country will do, what your competitors will do. It depends upon what your competitors throughout the world will do. So therefore, you should look at the entire world as your market. You should look at the entire world as your sourcing arena for talent, for components or for raw materials, et cetera, for your finance. So once you get to that global mindset, you will also compete with the best global leader in terms of quality, in terms of productivity, in terms of human resources policies, in terms of finance, you know, in terms of disclosures, in terms of corporate governance, et cetera, et cetera. So I would say that look at the entire world as your playing field.
Well, perhaps on those very, I think, apt words and apt closing, I would like to thank you, Mr. Murthy, for giving us your time.
Our pleasure.
We understand completely how busy you are, and we thank you for having inspired many young minds out here.
Absolute pleasure.
We also hope that you will keep your relationship with Cornell very strong, and you'll come back to us and visit us and give us your wisdom.
Absolutely.
A small token of appreciation on our
Thanks
side.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.